This is Forum. I'm John Michaels, Public Affairs Radio Director, and we're going to be talking with the one of the deputies of the drug czar in the White House in Washington, D.C., Dr. Berta McGruss. Now, are you actually calling us, talking to us from Washington, D.C.?
I'm talking to you from my office right here in Washington, D.C. A beautiful day in the 80s and no humidity.
Well, I was going to say, now the upper plains out here, a lot of times we feel like we're, all the problems are in L.A., they're in New York, they're in Washington, they're in Miami, that's what TV is like. But I believe you know that drugs, alcohol, we've had a large push for, drinking and driving during the prom season here. The Upper Plains rural area is just as bad or worse sometimes.
It is certainly. There's no parts of our country that are exempt from this problem. Everyone has, inner city schools, suburban schools, parochial schools, private schools, rural areas. We see patterns of drug use that are very concerning across the country. No area is really devoid of them.
No, you have some background in methamphetamine, I believe, right?
I have some background on several drugs. I've done extensive work on cocaine and how it affects the brain, and also trying to devise medications to treat addiction. I've done a limited amount of work on the active ingredient of marijuana and a little bit of work on ecstasy and some reviews on methamphetamine, but not hands-on research on methamphetamine itself.
Well, ecstasy reminds me of the days when the government actually was experimenting with LSD. I think the Central Intelligence Agency was. Do you have access to government files on some of that stuff?
I can give you a very interesting anecdote about that.
Yes.
Because when I was a graduate student 3,000 years ago, I received government-distributed LSD for basic research after the program was stopped by the U.S. government. So I was given the vials of pure LSD to do research and try to understand how it works.
Well, a lot of people, they see cocaine popular with the Hollywood set. Cocaine really, it's prior to the crack cocaine, but tell us what cocaine is like when you say you've had some experience with how that affects the brain, and then we'll get into the crack cocaine.
Well, cocaine does quite a number on the brain. First of all, it's highly addictive. Secondly, it does affect the blood vessel supply to the brain. It can cause clamping of blood vessels to the brain. And we think that's the reason that when you look at images of blood supply in the brain, there's certain parts of the brain where the blood supply just dries up after long-term use of cocaine.
And crack cocaine, though, is even more addictive.
Crack cocaine has a higher addictive potential for a very simple reason. The basic molecule is identical to powder cocaine, but the way it's constructed, it makes it easy to heat and to smoke. And the faster drug gets into the brain, the more addictive it is.
Well, you have many long credentials and background and awards, and you're an authority on this. But how much can the government really do? We've had a war on drugs since, quite a few administrations.
It's an excellent question. We have very good news to report.
Good.
Drug use amongst young people, high school students, 8th, 10th, and 12th graders combined, has dropped 24% since 2001. That's really good news. There really is a downward trend. It represents 860,000 fewer young people that are using drugs now than used 5 or 6 years ago. That's great. And that is so important because of two really fundamental reasons. First, young people are much more susceptible to becoming addicted if they start drug use at an early age. And secondly, if you interfere with drug use at this phase, you may set a pattern for life for them.
Well, Advertising 101 is Pepsi found out back in the 1950s, if you've got them by 13, you've got them for life.
That's right. And that's really one of our most deepest concerns, because there's very good evidence that kids who start using drugs before the age of 14 are 6 times more likely to be in treatment for abuse or addiction as adults. 6 times. I mean, that's unacceptably high.
Well, this leads us to, I think, one of the things that the reason that we're talking is drug testing in schools. This drop that you've seen across the country, there's a lot of schools that are doing drug testing. Is this part of that?
Well, random drug testing is a different concept than just drug testing. There are over 4,100 schools in the country that are doing random drug testing. What that means is the way the Department of Education program is structured is that it's a public health approach to the problem. If you randomly test students, you give them a reason to resist peer pressure to use drugs. That's its primary purpose. Give kids a reason to say no when they go to parties, when their friends are asking them to use. And we know there's good evidence that most kids get drugs from their friends.
Well, yeah, peer group pressure is I think we all, most grandparents wouldn't dare tell their kids what they did when they were in high school. We're speaking with Dr. Roberta McGrath from the Drug Czar's office in Washington, D.C. The main thing, I think, is that what can we do to educate and communicate to people at that key age? I guess what I'm leading up to is, if you watch the 6 o'clock news on television, whether it's CBS, ABC, or NBC, it's all pharmaceuticals. When these kids get to be 10, 12, 13, they've been bombarded with thousands of commercials to take a pill for everything from genitalia to stool softener to take drugs.
I must say that obviously we have a culture that does resort to drugs to treat a lot of ailments which are natural, and we also resort to drugs to treat what we find periods of unhappiness and stress, which is normal part of daily life. If we didn't have highs and lows in life, ups and down periods, it wouldn't be much fun, would it? It would be quite boring. And I think that we certainly need to recognize that life has positives and negatives throughout. That's part of the joy of life, is looking forward, looking upward, looking backwards. There's so many there's so many stages in life that are not perfect, and that, I think, is important. But random student drug testing, the key thing is that it tries to educate young people, give them a reason to avoid illicit drugs, which have a higher level of danger than prescription drugs, if prescription drugs are used according to medical practice. Now, prescription drugs are also being abused by young people, and that's a deep level of concern for me and for this office. Because a lot of young people are beginning to think that prescription drugs, after all, they're medicines, are safer than street drugs. And we have to get the point across to them and their parents that they are not safe when they are not used for medical purposes according to a doctor's prescription.
In the same line, Doctor, do a lot of people go back to alcohol, thinking that that's the preferred drug of choice or the accepted drug of choice?
Yes, well, alcohol is number one drug of choice for a population, followed by marijuana, and coming up very fast is prescription drug abuse. So that's a real problem. And these kind of programs, which are non-punitive, confidential, designed to help people, is a form of prevention that many schools have opted for, because they know that it does help deter drug use in their population. It also introduces a culture that disapproves of drug use in the school system.
What is the legality for school systems with random drug testing? I'm sure you've had many talks about this.
Yes. Well, the Supreme Court has ruled twice, in 1995 and 2002, proclaiming that because schools are a special situation, that schools are permitted to engage in random student drug testing for students that are involved in competitive extracurricular activities. They also said that if parents and their students opt into the program, they volunteer, that's fine as well. And so we see schools that have a combination of kids who are in extracurricular and a combination of others who are not, but who have volunteered into the program. The legalities are that the Supreme Court considers it permissible. The Department of Education grants have very rigid constraints on how to do these programs to protect young people.
Now, a lot of schools make parents or force parents to give drugs for hypertension, what do you call it, Ritalin?
Ritalin for hyperactivity.
Yes. Some people might say, is that a contradiction?
Well, it really is not, because there's a big difference between bringing a child from an abnormal state to a normal state and bringing them from a normal state to an abnormal state. I hope that, let me try to clarify. A child who's diagnosed with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is not achieving to their capacity, usually, because they can't focus. They can't really develop the kind of self-restraint on their attention that is needed to learn materials, to memorize, to sit still. They also can be disruptive to others, and they can be disruptive to materials in the classroom, especially at a younger age.
Well, I'm glad that we have someone who is, you know, you've worked your whole life in this, Dr. Madras, with the drug office in Washington, D.C., the drug czar. You're the deputy, you might say. Tell us a little bit about the office that you work for.
The office that my portfolio is to reduce the demand for drugs in the country, which means to engage in prevention, intervention, and treatment. So the supply side, which is involved with law enforcement and international supply issues, is something that I draw a concrete wall around me and barrier myself off, because that's a completely different set of expertise and a completely different set of people.
Well, Doctor, the 4,000 schools that do the random drug testing, if somebody does test positive, it's not like they're hauled off to jail. They work with them. This is kept private, or how do they do that?
Well, this is the key issue. If, as I said, first and foremost, it's a deterrent. If a young person tests positive in the school, it's not even considered positive yet. First, the sample has to be sent to an independent lab to confirm that it is, in fact, positive. And even then, that's not good enough. A medical review officer has to look at the results and call the parent and ask the parent, is there a prescription drug or any other reason why your child is testing positive? And if the parent says, no, this is the first I've heard of it, then the medical review officer will say, well, according to this test, your child is tested positive. So the child is notified, the parent is notified, and the school provides links to counseling. And the counseling is critical, because the counselor's role is to try to identify where this young person lies. Are they addicted? Are they abusing? Are they using very infrequently? And try to target the level of care depending on where they are.
And this would also be a good deterrent for, like, steroids and athletics and other concerns. Now, the funding, are you saying that with these 4,000 schools that are doing this, they're receiving funding from the federal government then?
The vast majority are not.
They're not. Interesting. Okay.
We have close to 600 confirmed schools that have received federal funding, and we're going to be adding on with this new grant probably a few hundred more schools. But the vast majority, which is about 80% or more of the schools, find the funds through other resources because they are committed to the program. That's why they've implemented. This is available for insight, as is the Department of Education. We work in close conjunction with them, and they are our partners in this.
Well, Dr. Bertamadris, of the give us your official title now, the long one.
Deputy Director for Demand Reduction in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy.
And it's right from the White House, and want to thank you very much for being with us on Forum.
You're very welcome. It's been a delight.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.